Good evening, and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Just for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author, Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Is Marcus Garvey stock, Marcus Garvey ship, and Marcus Garvey's Black Cross nurse?
Okay, Marcus Garvey. Now, here's a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier about where our heads are at today. Marcus Garvey is a radical thinker. And I think that the renewed interest in Marcus Garvey in the past 15 years or so, 20 years, and I say that generally because for those who are really, really in the know and people who have been really aware of radical movements, everything from Garvey, and there were guys before him too, through Malcolm, that people were aware of him, but I say it's a general awareness of Marcus Garvey. He's become much more of a well-known name in the past 15 or 20 years, and as a result, anything by him or connected to the movement he founded, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. The Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, was incredible for its day and what Garvey was able to accomplish. His aim was to unite all people of color and have a connection with Africa. What actually brought him down in the end was part of his shipping line, the Black Star Line, and I think that's one of the pieces that that you mentioned. It was a shipping line that Garvey founded, and the idea was that goods produced in Africa would be imported into the U.S. and money would go back into Africa. Goods would be produced by people of African descent here, would be shipped back, and there would be this constant ebb and flow between Africa and the United States and the Caribbean as well, because after all, Garvey was a Jamaican. So now, at one point, and you have to figure that there were probably more people connected with the UNIA than there were people who directly connected with, let's say, Malcolm. I mean, the people who were card-carrying members of the UNIA. It was a tremendous movement. And of course, as such, the FBI here, Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, set out to undo Garvey. I mean, he was the real top target, more than crime in this country or anything else. He became their prime target. So he had people infiltrate the movement. And at one point, when Garvey's Black Star Line, the shipping line, was about to acquire another ship, they hadn't yet put the money down on it, but they were pretty much in contract to acquire this ship. And it was to be called the Phyllis Wheatley, after the great poet. And as I say, that they had not yet as yet acquired the ship, but one of their people, one of the UNIA people in the publicity department, soliciting some money to buy the ship, because they were constantly soliciting funds and selling stock shares in the Black Star Line. Somebody airbrushed the name of the ship, the Phyllis Wheatley, onto the photograph that was used in the material sent out through the post office to solicit funds. And that one thing was able to undo Garvey. The FBI had their excuse, which was soliciting funds through the mail illegally because it was just a loophole. The illegality of it was that Garvey didn't yet own that ship. And so they charged him with mail fraud, and he was sentenced to something like 30 years, and he was sent to a prison in Georgia. There was such a hue and cry from people both here in the United States and throughout the world, because he had people in the movement in England and everywhere. There were people in the UNI movement. Anyway, there was such a hue and cry that they were forced to let him go. He was allowed to leave prison, and he was deported. And after that, the movement kind of fell apart, though he went first to Jamaica, then back to England, went to England, and the movement sort of sputtered and died out there. About 1940s, the late 40s, it kind of just sputtered out. Yes, well, again, these are names that I think everybody should be aware of. Carver was an educator, scientist, teacher, humanitarian. And I think most people just think of George Washington Carver and they think of the peanut. But beyond his experiments with the peanut and really bringing that into our lives, anybody who's had a peanut butter sandwich should really remember why we have things like peanut butter and how important it is in terms of a nutritious food. Carver was interested in finding ways to develop nutritious food. He did a lot of experiments with food, finding ways to make different kinds of flour. Flour, for instance, from sweet potato. And in this same sale, I not only have that photograph of George Washington Carver, but we also have a recipe, or suggestion for different ways to use a sweet potato. We know about his teaching and at Tuskegee and so forth. He's another one of these giant figures that so much impacted so much on people's lives. Sadly enough, I must say, I think that there are two figures that both of them teachers and humanitarians, and that would be Carver and George and Booker T. Washington. And I think that people kind of have taken them for granted. And I think in the case of Booker T. Washington, for instance, he's gotten something of a bad rap as a compromiser and appeaser. And I think that that's because people thinking in more radical terms, kind of people divided up at a certain point in the 20th century as Du Bois men and Booker T. Washington. And I think that if we look back at Booker T., I think he's a lot more important than so many modern people would like to dismiss him as kind of the bootstrap, the appeaser, and Carver too. I think the issue is that there's just so much material connected with them out there that we've kind of taken them for granted, and that's unfair. I think that both of them should be studied more by today's scholars and so forth.
How does he compare to Du Bois?
That's what I'm saying, is that they're really very different. Du Bois is the more radical voice of the black community in the 20th century. You remember that they're pretty much they overlap a bit, but they're both strong voices in the early part of the 20th century.
Which one has the most demand for from the collectors? Yes,
I'd say Du Bois, of course. I mean, I find Du Bois a tremendous figure. I as I say, though, they have different roles in the evolution of Black thought and race progress in the 20th century.
So Du Bois's items are worth more today than...
Well, there's more. I think more people are interested today in terms of collectors and so forth in Du Bois, and I think that we tend to think in more radical terms today, and so we relate more to W.E.B. Du Bois than we relate to Booker T. Washington, and it would depend. For instance, I had some manuscript notes of Booker T. Washington and the sale, and I had a few last year as well, and they brought big prices. Let me see, I have my catalog here, but I think that this group of 12 pages of manuscript notes for speeches by Booker T. Washington brought $4,600 hammer. Now, what that means in an auction, by the way, is when we talk about a hammer price, that means the price that was in the room when the auctioneer says, going, going, gone, bang, and he wraps his little hammer down. It's that figure. But in fact, the buyer has to pay that plus 20% to the auction house. Otherwise, the auction house can't stay in business. We don't make the money. Our consignor makes the money. For instance, in this instance, $4,600, that goes to the consignor. We charge 20% above that to the buyer, and that's what the auction house makes. That's what any auction house makes, is a percentage over the bid. But before I wander too far off on explaining that, that's a good price, $4,600, at probably about $5,400 with those premiums, the commissions. Last year, I had a similar group of notes from Booker T. that sold for $10,000. So it really depends on what the material is. I think a similar grouping of notes in Du Bois' hand might bring more, simply because I think that today's audience is just a little bit more geared toward Du Bois than they are toward Booker T. But then that's all speculation, because if you have the right two people in the room who are really interested, the bidding on something like that could go anywhere. The image that appears on the cover of the Last Swan catalog of African-American material is a photograph by a very well-known photographer by the name of Ernest Withers. And that was it's a photograph taken at the strike of sanitation workers in Memphis that Dr. Martin Luther King went down to lend his support to. They had been really having a rough time there, being harassed and so forth by the local racists. And so Dr. King went down there to help and participated in the march with them. And those signs that said, "I am a man," or were the placards. There were actually a couple of placards that they carried, but that's the one that we know best. A week later, when Dr. King was killed, they were still demonstrating. Their new placard was printed, and that said, "End racism, honor Dr. King." Both of those signs are extremely rare. In late 96, I was pulling material together for the 1997 sale at Swan Galleries, and I had a dear friend who's passed now, an African-American collector by the name of Oliver Ramsey. And Oliver had a huge collection of books and related material, African-American material. And I was at his apartment in New York City, and he said, you might be interested in this really strange thing. It's a very, very scarce thing. And he pulled this placard out of the closet, and it was that "I am a man" placard. It turns out Oliver had actually been down there in Memphis and marched, and he took his placard home. Being a collector, I guess he saw it, he knew that it was going to be something important, and he saved it. And I don't think many were saved, because in the years that I've been looking for others, I've only seen two others. So anyway, the end of the story is that I suggested, Oliver wanted to sell that placard, and I suggested we put it in the song sale, which I did. I cataloged it. And I think I had an estimate on it, because I thought it was a very, very good piece of $1,000 to $1,500 or $1,500 to $2,500. We always, in auctions, you always give a low and a high, and you hope that people will bid in between those two figures. And as it turned out, the placard sold for, the poster, whatever you want to call it, sold for $5,200. It was an astonishing figure, really, for a placard, a civil rights placard. Since then, I've had people ask me, collectors ask me to find them one. I've been unable to. I have one standing order from somebody who said, the sky's the limit. It doesn't matter what the cost is. And I know that one other copy sold for about $10,000. It is iconic of the civil rights movement. It says everything. I am a man. And by the way, it's a kind of harkens back to the early image of the kneeling slave that was created by Wedgwood, Josiah Wedgwood, for the Anti-Slavery Society in England in the late 18th century, that showed the slave kneeling, and it said, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And this is kind of affirmation of it. I am a man. And so I think it's a wonderful full circle of confirmation.